Hello, this is Tom Scott with the Ford County Chronicle for Wednesday, May 21st, 2025. We begin our reading on the front page from the Paxton City Council, Backyard Chickens to be Put Before Voters. Advisory question will appear on March 2026 ballot. Paxton. The next primary election ballot, on March 17th, 2026, will include a non-binding referendum asking Paxton voters if they feel the city should allow backyard chickens. During a joint meeting of the Paxton City Council's Community Committee and License Permit, Zoning, and Insurance Committee on Thursday, May 13th, aldermen voted 3-1 to advance the advisory question to the next election, with the full council expected to approve the specific language during the next meeting on Tuesday, June 10th. Prior to the vote, aldermen heard from a crowd of some 30 residents, most in favor of relaxing the city's rules to allow for hens, but not roosters, to be kept on residential properties. While just one resident showed up to voice concerns about the idea, aldermen noted that many more residents they had spoken to prior to the meeting had expressed opposition as well. "I've had many, many people tell me they don't want chickens," Alderman Mike Wilson said. "I have also been contacted by opponents of the proposal," Alderman Dean Geiken said. "A non-binding referendum that would be on the ballot would allow those in support to vote for it, or it would allow those against to vote against it. It would be an equitable way to see what the real support in town is for this. It's an election. It's the democratic way." City Attorney Tony Shearing said he would draft the language of the ballot question prior to June's full council meeting. It would say something to the effect of, "Shall the city of Paxton permit the keeping of hens on residentially zoned property within its corporate living limits?" Shearing told the aldermen. "It's non-binding, so 100% of voters could vote in favor of it, and the city council still could not do it. Conversely, 1% could vote in favor of it, and the city council could still vote to do it. But I think one of the benefits of having an initiative like this, in addition to its being kind of the democratic way, is it would obviously, I think, force some of those conversations about the pros and cons of allowing backyard chickens to be had, so that people can learn that maybe their concerns are overblown, or maybe allowing chickens wouldn't be as bad as some of the opponents think it would be, or maybe there are some perspectives that the opponents have that the proponents have discounted that don't deserve that level of discounting." While some residents did not appear happy with pursuing an advisory ballot question, since it would not be binding, Wilson noted that the results will not be ignored. "For me personally, I would have a very difficult time not voting for something that the residents overwhelmingly approved on the ballot," Wilson told the crowd on hand at City Hall. "Take that for what it's worth." Only Alderman Joel Reinhart voted against pursuing the advisory question, as Geiken was joined by Alderman Kristen Larson and Justin Withers in voting yes. The only member of the two committees absent was Alderman Rob Pacey. While numerous nearby communities already allow backyard chickens, they currently can only be kept in Paxton if they are at least 150 feet from any home, church, school building, or public way, according to city code. Restrictions that make raising them impossible on most residential properties, noted Larson, the chairman of the community committee. Larson suggested the rules be relaxed, but that restrictions to be put in place to address concerns that have been expressed by some residents. Among her suggestions were that the city limit the number of hens allowed and require permits for chicken coops and runs, which would also need to be at least 30 feet from neighboring homes and fully enclosed within a fully fenced-in backyard. Resident Beth Tabor said she believes the 30-foot suggested setback might be too restrictive, though with many residential lots being only 50 feet wide. In response, Larson noted that the minimum distance could be reduced to perhaps 25 feet. The number doesn't necessarily have to stay that way, Larson said, noting that other towns have a setback of as little as 20 feet. I'm not set on that number. Meanwhile, resident Paul Crutcher, former alderman, suggested eliminating the proposed fencing requirement, which he claimed could be cost prohibitive for quite a few people. I think that's just necessarily unburdensome, Crutcher said. However, Geiken noted that requiring a fence would help address the concerns of residents who otherwise would be entirely against allowing hens in town. Some are opposed to the idea primarily because they feel it's just going to be another eyesore, Geiken said, noting, though, that the idea would be a little more appealing to them if fences were required. Larson noted that fencing, in addition to hiding the coops, would help keep out predators looking for a meal. Geiken asked how the city would enforce the rules for backyard chickens if they were to be allowed. Mayor Bill Ingold noted that the city's police officers and code enforcement officer already have a pretty full plate working on other tasks. Larson suggested that the city appoint an urban chicken educational liaison to assist the police if we feel the pressure on them would be too great. On behalf of the police department, Larson said the liaison could handle permit applications and document chicken coops' compliance with city code. Also, in the event there are complaints about specific coops, the liaison could help police work with the property owner to address the issues by doing some of the legwork. Reinhardt noted that the city would be able to revoke permits for a number of reasons. Even with chickens not allowed, some residents are reportedly keeping them anyway. Geiken noted that a property owner on South High Street recently put up a full coop and run, presumably to house chickens in violation of city code. Resident Derek Babb said his neighbor keeps chickens too, but he does not mind. I've had neighbors that have had chickens for years, Babb said. I don't smell it, I don't hear it. They keep their coops nice. They keep everything clean. Babb said allowing chickens via permit would be a win-win for both Paxton, which would bring in some revenue through permit fees, and its residents, who would have a source of fresh eggs. Resident Dave Fredrickson said chickens would also provide educational opportunities for local kids, who could also see the benefit of more family time as they maintain coops with their parents. Truthfully, for these young kids right here, it's best to have time spent with their mums and dads than in front of an Xbox, Fredrickson said. It would be nice to have it where you can have some family time, which, in this day and age, is kind of few and far between. Resident Rebecca Rutledge, the only opponent of backyard chickens who was present last week, so she is concerned about what would happen if the town could not enforce the backyard chicken ordinance it would enact. Rutledge also noted that recent salmonella outbreaks have been linked to backyard poultry across the U.S., and she is concerned that chicken feces tracked into businesses around town, for example, could cause a public health problem. Rutledge also said she was concerned about a potential influx of wildlife as a result of chickens attacking predators. Geiken noted that Rutledge, while the only opponent present, is not the only resident against allowing chickens. I've had one person in my ward speak up in favor, Geiken said. Everybody else has not. Rutledge noted that compliance with city rules is already a problem when it comes to backyard chickens, with some residents apparently keeping chickens in violation of the rules. Rutledge said that should be a big concern. Proponents of backyard chickens in attendance, though, stressed that they want to do it legally within the established rules and expect most others will too. Returning to the front page, we have from the Ford County Board, error in lease needs correction, says panel's chairman, Newald. Tillable acreage listed in it needs to be lowered, Paxton. Toward the end of Monday's hour-long meeting of the Ford County Board's Farm Committee, its chairman, Greg Newald of Rural Lota, proposed correcting the county's cash rent lease agreement with Nick Purcell for the county-owned Hatfield-Bowen Farm in Button Township, saying the leased acreage should be lowered to reflect what is actually farmable. In March, County Board approved Purcell's $320 per acre bid for the cash rent leasing of 125.7 acres of the 157 acre farm this crop season. According to Niewald, Purcell later questioned how the county arrived at the 125.7 acre number, then ended up planting crops on only 119.8 acres. While Purcell's previous lease for the farm from 2023 included 126.5 acres, Niewald noted that 118.7 acres, a number much closer to what Purcell said he was able to farm this spring, was the acreage mentioned in the minutes from a special board meeting in April 2023 when the board was discussing whether to pursue a custom farming contract for the farm's tillable acreage. Niewald said he would like the county board to amend the current lease to reflect the acres he is actually farming, or instead remove at least 3.1 acres off his current agreement, reducing the total to 121.9. Board member Tom McQuinn of Rural Paxton said he believes the lease legally cannot be amended, though, without also redoing the rebidding process. Board member Cindy Erke of Rural Roberts agreed. You'd have to fix it for the future, but you can't change this one now because it was bid on for 125.7 acres, Erke said. Niewald said he would consult Ford County State's Attorney Andrew Killian for his opinion on how to proceed. Meanwhile, the committee authorized Niewald to work with the Farm Service Agency to correct the listed acreage for the Hatfield-Bowen farm as it pertains to ground used for agriculture production versus land not used for non-agricultural production. The board's 9-1 vote on March 12th to accept Purcell's bid and enter into a cash rent lease agreement effective from March 10th through November 30th brought the farmland southeast of Paxton back into agricultural production after a one-year hiatus caused by a disagreement over its use. Besides Purcell, the only other bidder was John Fair, whose bid was for just short of $177 per acre. The board voted 8-4 in February to move forward with soliciting bids for the cash rent leasing of the farm's tillable acreage rather than proceeding with its previously proposed enrollment into the U.S. Department of Agriculture's Conservation Reserve Program. Also on Monday's meeting, Niewald said he was continuing to work with Killian to draft language for a potential CRP contract with a nonprofit farm manager and operator, such as the Lotus Sportsman Club, that would handle the paperwork and accept CRP payments on behalf of the county for the Hatfield-Bowen farm upon its enrollment into the program. There remain questions about the potential liability exposure to the county. According to Niewald, Killian indicated that ultimately everything is going to ultimately fall on the landowner, which is the county in this case. So he's like, we've got to make sure we protect the county in this case. McQuinn said the nonprofit operator should be required to maintain insurance and name the county as additional insured. As far as insurance goes, they would be number one, we would be number two as far as liability, Quinn said. State laws applying to land open for public use, as the farm would continue to be under CRP, might also protect the county from liability, Erke said. There is an actual law where the landowner is not responsible for any injuries or anything that would happen on the property, Erke said. We almost have the same liability now, McQuinn noted. If a car runs off the road and ends up on our ground and they decide they want to sue us, they can. And I'm not too sure that we don't have an umbrella policy right now that covers us in top normal stuff. Erke noted that the CRP contract would be only for paperwork management. It would not give the nonprofit group exclusive access to the property, which would be publicly accessible for bird watching and hiking, for example. The intention is completely different than a farm lease like we have with Mr. Purcell, Erkey said. We don't really want to lock it up under someone else's uses and permissions. Erkey mentioned that CRP enrollment is being accepted by the USDA once again. He suggested that a conservation plan for the farm be created as required by a 1985 state statute applying to land with highly erodible soil that is used for conservation, she noted. Doing so could provide the county more freedom in the contracting of the work. The committee also briefly discussed the topic of whether to re-enroll the Hatfield-Bowen Farm into the Illinois Department of Natural Resources Illinois Recreational Access Program, IRAP, making the land open for public hunting via a lottery each fall. If that were to happen, at least 40 acres would be needed to be enrolled, the minimum required by the IDNR. With only 31 acres of non-tillable pasture ground on the farm, it is likely that some of the farm's tillable ground would need to be involved too. The enrolled acreage would be opened up for youth firearm deer hunting season in early October and archery deer hunting season for adults and youth in late October and late December, with the hunters allowed to use the site via an IDNR lottery. The farm was the most applied for site among IRAP enrolled land in the entire state under a previous 2-year IRAP lease agreement with the IDNR that was officially voided last month. McQuinn said earlier this month he sees no reason the farmland, which he described as very poor for continued agriculture production, should not be put back into IRAP. If the county were to proceed with the IRAP re-enrollment, a new lease would need to be approved. Meanwhile, noted that the IDNR's leases for the IRAP program contain an indemnification clause excluding the IDNR from any civil liability, and he was told such language is standard, meaning the county can expect the same in a new lease. Erkey said Ford County's own liability concerns would be covered, though through waivers and releases signed by the hunters. The county's other two farms, the Ford County Nursing Home Farm in Patton Township and the Bowden Grider Farm in Button Township, are currently being farmed by Purcell, whose 2-year cash rent lease for the farms expires in November. We'll turn to the inside of the paper for a very short item from the Ford County Emergency Management Agency. Friday dust storm causes accidents and damage in Gibson City. The Ford County Emergency Management Agency activated and deployed storm plotters to the spotters to the southern part of the county to track the incoming weather on Friday, May 16th. EMA Coordinator Terry Whitebird and Deputy Coordinator Danny Neal headed east on Illinois 9 from Paxton and encountered a developing wall of dust caused by dry downbursts from severe thunderstorms just to the south of the county. We promptly relayed this report to the U.S. National Weather Service in Chicago, and accordingly, a dust storm warning was issued for Ford County. The dust moved from south to north across the region. Unfortunately, the dust storm created quite a bit of problems, from broken branches and wires down in Paxton, Gibson City, and Piper City, to accidents along U.S. 24, Illinois 115, and Illinois 165. The EMA responded to several locations to help out with traffic control and debris removal. On the front page, we have, and inside the paper this week, we have pictures of the Gibson City Melvin Sibley High School graduation. The Gibson City Melvin Sibley's High School graduation ceremony was Saturday, May 17th, in the school's gymnasium. Valedictorian was Elizabeth Giroux, and salutatorian was Addison Kirchenfolk. And from the Ford County Public Health Department, senior citizens learn of services available to them through program. Piper City. Representatives of the Ford County Public Health Department met with senior citizens at the Piper City Library on Tuesday, May 13th to explain services available. Caregiver advisor Becky Beck, who does assessments of those needing in-home assistance and develops a care plan for their caregivers, explained that eligibility for the community care program is based on the person's assets, not on income. Services for in-home care receives include assistance with daily living needs, personal care and grooming, housekeeping, laundry, food preparations, grocery shopping, and transportation. Starting June 1st, the Chris Rural Mass Transit District will be providing rides to doctor's appointment and other needs of elderly and handicapped persons living in their own homes, Beck said. Perry McQuarrie, a community health nurse, serves as the health department's vaccine coordinator and organizes its health clinics. For information about other services provided, people can call the health department in Paxton at 217-379-9281 or visit its website at fordcountyphd.org. Also, the public libraries in Piper City, Gibson City, and Paxton have booklets that explain all services available. Now we'll turn to the obituaries in the Ford County Chronicle for Wednesday, May 21st. Jean L. Elliott, Rantoul. Jean Leon Elliott, 90, of Rantoul, died at 8:20 p.m. Thursday, May 15th at Carl Foundation Hospital in Urbana. Funeral services were held at noon Tuesday, May 20th at the Bear Family Funeral Services in Paxton, with the Reverend Aaron Dawson officiating. Burial followed in Glen Cemetery in Paxton. Memorials may be made to the St. Jude Children's Research Hospital. Marianne Hutcherson, Rantoul. Marianne Hutcherson, 79, of Paxton, formerly of Rantoul, died at 6 a.m. Sunday, May 11th at Accolade Healthcare of Paxton Senior Living. Funeral arrangements were incomplete at the time of publication. Tricia Pat Nelson, Paxton. Tricia Pat Nelson, 68, of Paxton, died at 12:57 p.m. Friday, May 16th at Fairfield Senior Living and Rehab in Fairfield. Funeral services will be at 11 a.m. Wednesday, May 28th at Bear Family Funeral Services in Paxton, with the Reverend Keith Ruther officiating. Burial will follow in Glen Cemetery in Paxton. Visitation will be from 5 to 7 p.m. Tuesday, May 27th, and from 10 to 11 a.m. Wednesday, May 28th at the funeral home. Memorials may be made to the Evangelical Covenant Church of Paxton, Gideon's International, Alzheimer's Association, or a charity of the donor's choice. Mary Ann Saylor, Manning, Iowa. Mary Ann Grote Saylor, 84, sister of a Gibson City resident, died Saturday, February 1st, 2025, surrounded by her family at St. Anthony Nursing Home in Carroll, Indiana. A mass of Christian burial was held at Friday, February 7th at the Sacred Heart Catholic Church in Manning, Iowa, with burial at Sacred Heart Cemetery. Dolores M. Turner, Paxton. Dolores M. Turner, 84, of Danville, formerly of Paxton, died peacefully on Thursday, May 15th. Funeral services were held Monday, May 19th at Bear Family Funeral Services in Paxton, with the Reverend Adam Harmon officiating. Burial followed in Glen Cemetery in Paxton. Memorials may be made to the Central Christian Church in Danville. Patricia Ann Wilkin, Chatsworth. Patricia Ann Wilkin, 82, of Chatsworth, died Saturday, May 17th. At Fairview Haven Retirement Community in Fairbury. Her funeral services were held 10:30 a.m. Friday, May 23rd at the St. Paul Lutheran Church in Roberts, with the Reverend Matt Gerdes officiating. Family suggests memorials be given to St. Paul Lutheran Church in Roberts, Fairview Haven Retirement Community in Fairbury, or the Prairie Central High School Fine Arts, or FFA, department. We'll return to the front page for the latest in the Robbie Dinkins case. GCMS to select hearing officer in Dinkins' case in Gibson City. Robbie Dinkins is appealing the Gibson City Melvin Sibley School Board's decision to fire him amid claims that he maintained inappropriate relationships with students. GCMS Superintendent Jeremy Darnell said Wednesday, May 14th, that he received Dinkins' written request for a hearing be held before a board-selected hearing officer paid for in full by the school district on Tuesday, May 13th. Dinkins' mailed notice was postmarked Friday, May 9th, within the legally required 17-day time frame from his April 23rd termination date. Under rules established for the dismissal of tenured teachers in the Illinois School Code, the Illinois State Board of Education is required to provide the school board with its rotating master list of qualified impartial hearing officers. The board must then select one name from that list and notify both Dinkins and the ISBE's chief legal officer in Chicago. The hearing officer must be available to start the hearing within 75 days and conclude the hearing within 120 days of their selection. Within 10 days of the selection of the hearing officer, they are required to hold a pre-hearing conference with both parties for the purpose of, among other things, setting a schedule. The schedule would include a deadline for Dinkins to file his response to the board's charges against him, which include Dinkins having repeatedly crossed the boundaries of the employee-student relationship to such an extent that his students' parents perceived his actions as the grooming of those children for sexual abuse. The schedule would also include deadlines for the production of discovery and disclosures, plus the dates, times, and locations of any subsequent pre-hearing conferences. Parties and the hearing officer may agree to a location for the hearing. If there is a dispute, the hearing officer is required to choose a location within the district's boundaries. The hearing would be closed to the public unless one of the parties requests that it be open and the hearing officer so orders. During the hearing, both parties will make their cases via evidence and witness testimony, after which they can submit post-hearing written briefs. Within 30 days after the hearing ends, the hearing officer will issue a recommendation on whether Dinkins should be retained or dismissed, along with findings of facts stating the reasons for the recommended action. Within 45 days after receiving the hearing officer's findings of fact and recommendation, the board would render a written order stating whether Dinkins is to be retained or dismissed. Dinkins, who taught 8th grade math and coached 8th grade boys basketball and boys track at GCMS Middle School, and was head coach of the Fisher GCMS High School Cooperative Soccer Team, has declined to comment to the Chronicle about the allegation that led to his firing. As of this week, no criminal charges had been filed in Ford County Circuit Court. And that's all the time we have for today, this week's reading of the Ford County Chronicle. This is Tom Scott. I look forward to reading with you again very soon.